LinkedIn presents.
You know, one of the things I feel really fortunate in the work that I do is that I have been able to build some relationships and friendships with some pretty amazing chief people officers over the years. And one of my favorites is today's guest, Pat Waters. Pat is the chief people officer at UKG. She has a storied career as a chief people officer in a range of high growth technology companies. And this is a special episode of Redefining Work Reports that was recorded from a VIP AMA that we did in the Amplify Talent community with Pat. And we go deep on a lot of topics that will certainly be relevant to all of you navigating the people function in today's world of work. So we'll be right back with that conversation after a brief word from our sponsor. People have always been the key to unlocking business performance. Never has that been more true than today. I'm Lars Schmidt, and this is the Redefining Work Podcast. In each episode, we speak with business leaders who are influencing modern work and people practices. This podcast is your key to understanding the link between business performance and progressive people strategies. And if you're a people leader wanting to have an impact on your business, I encourage you to join our community for progressive people leaders at amplifytalent.com/community. This community is unlike anything you've experienced before. Want more direct insight? Here are some words from community members Chloe Sesta Jacobs, Noah Warder, and Balbina Knight.
The caliber of humans that I have met in this group is like nothing I've experienced before.
It is truly the safest community I've ever been a part of.
One of the things I love so much about the Amplify community is having the opportunity to connect with a global group of peers.
And if you're a business leader on the market for a transformative people leader, be sure to check out our HR executive search services at amplifytalent.com. Now, on to the show.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Pat and I, God, we first met, I was totally familiar with you. I'm going to go back to 2015 was when we first met live, but it was when it was at LinkedIn Talent Connect. Pat was doing one of the opening keynotes with Brendan Brown, who Pat was the CPO of LinkedIn at the time. Brendan was the global head of TA. So I was talking about the partnership between TA and HR. Ambrosia Vertesi and I were doing a keynote on unveiling HR open source to the world. And so we met each other online before that. That was the first time we met in person. And I've admired Pat's leadership then. She's had a lot of very media roles since, and I continue to admire her leadership. I think that she has had some tremendous experience. I think when you look at her LinkedIn profile and her resume and the work that she's done and where she's done it, that's up there with pretty much most of the top tier CPOs you're going to see in the space. But in my mind, it's not about where Pat's worked. It's about how she views the work and how she views her impact and how she views the role of HR as a business function, but also a function that really balances the needs of both the business and the employees. And that's not always an easy thing to do. But I've long admired how Pat has always, it's clear that that's been your North Star. And so as we began developing the speaker series in the community, Pat is a past guest instructor for the Amplify Talent cohorts. And I knew she was somebody that I would want to bring in to have all of you learn from. So Pat, that is my intro. What did I miss? Is there anything else that you want to share with the community members before we jump into the AMA?
Just I'm a fan of you. When you go through these conversations and you meet people, you approach these conversations with curiosity and care, not just for sound bites. You do it from a learning perspective and a sharing perspective. I long held the belief that HR should compete not with each other, right? I think their businesses should compete in products and services, but we should copy shamelessly and lift everybody up. And when I found that I'd bump into somebody in our space and like, oh, I'm not going to share the secret sauce, what I did to make my employees more engaged or figure out the secret code to inclusion or whatever that thing is. And I would ponder, why not? Like, why not lift the world? And I think that if you create really healthy companies globally, the impact globally is immeasurable, right? Just immeasurable. And so, Lars, I applaud you, your approach, your learning, the community you create. You're adored. You call, I answer. I mean, pretty much. So thank you for inviting me.
All right. Well, people who are listening aren't able to see me blush right now. People who are watching Ken, that's kind and I appreciate it. And I do appreciate you kind of opening with the open aspect of the world of work today, because, you know, again, I think we still run into those leaders from time to time. They're like, I'm not going to share my secrets. They're my trade secrets, but that's a pretty small number, I think, overall. And that trend continues to go in the direction that those leaders who think that way are kind of a relic of the past, because the future is open.
Yeah. Thank goodness it's changed.
Yeah. So I want to, before we kind of open this up to the community members for questions, I want to open and kind of maybe just level set with you on like where we are. I mean, in your career, you've seen a tremendous amount of shifts and evolution in the world of work, the world of business, the capabilities and expectations of the HR and people function, the internal and external challenges that our function has had to navigate, particularly over the last 4 years. Like, when you assessing all of that, how do you describe the world of HR today? HR, people, operations, however you want to frame it, like, how do you describe it today? What is the environment that we're in today?
That's a deep question that has many prongs, Lars. And I love the question because I know I've evolved and changed, and I know the craft has changed. If I reflect back on these 4 years, and I'll just make broad statements, there's always nuances, but the agility, the care, the learning, breaking down our assumptions. I thought I knew my craft. I thought I knew how to create a great employee experience. And then COVID hit and you know, social unrest and George Floyd and looking at how we support people, different communities. I was naive. I didn't have all the tools. I assumed too much in the ecosystem and where I had learned to porpoise, like I have a philosophy of porpoising down an organization to see if it's healthy, if it's working, and if it's not, tweak it and then porpoise back up and kind of look at the horizon line, the strategy. I had to like porpoise down on my vendors, my supply chain. I had to porpoise down on the impact on certain decisions. I think that the community has, you know, shown its strength, its agility, its compassion. I think we're learning how to navigate our own burnout and care. I think we have gotten a ton more appreciation than we've had in the past because of all the things we've had to navigate. Without this crap, without what we do, so many organizations would have not only floundered but failed, right? I am convinced that we are the secret sauce in an organization. If you take the company strategy, the thing that makes it work are the people. And if you unlock the talent, if you engage them, if you give them clarity on decision making and setting goals and all the tools that we know in our craft to be solid, then companies will rally and they'll be survive and thrive. And so we had to be at the tip of the spear, so to speak, during a lot of this change. They turned to us. I'm not chief medical officer, Lars. I don't know about you. But when I get asked questions about a pandemic, I'd be like, let me call a friend. And it was amazing how many people came together in the community to cross-pollinate and learn. That to me was an amazing gift.
Yeah,
I saw the chat, the communication, the sharing, the resiliency, the support, like take off. And that warms my heart.
Where do we still have to go, right? So if we take kind of that framing that I think you so aptly described in terms of, you know, our recent evolution and where we are today, where do we still need to go? And I'm going to frame this question with a bit more specificity. you know, you're on a range of boards. You obviously have been interacting with boards in a range of roles over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. You have a pretty good sense of both the C-suites, and kind of taking you out of the C-suite for a moment, their expectations for our function and their understanding of our function. And there's a gap between those things, you know, wide that gap may be. Occasionally there may be zero gap, right? They may have people that worked with high performing people teams and they understand what we're capable of. But I'm curious, like when you think about where we still have gaps that we need to continue developing in order to serve our businesses into the future, like where do you see those being?
Gosh, you know, when I talk about HR and the craft, there's like three buckets of expectations of the function. One is the administrative function, right? You think about startups, you think about a very traditional environment, perhaps where it's administrative, it's benefits, it's recruiting, it's compensation, it's the compliance stuff, right? And that's super important. That's what I call the platform layer of talent. But it kind of stops there because your leaders don't want much more than that, right? They think they understand the culture and what it takes and the org designs, and you administer and support those efforts. There's another bucket that works for a leader, could be the CEO, could be the COO even. It could be one of your key C-suites that have a talent vision that really index on, say, leadership, excellence in leadership, or unlocking, you know, basket weaving, you know, you name it.
Right.
And the HR team will rally and manifest that vision. They know how to translate someone's vision, their strategy into an actionable item, right? And that I think is really a critical skill. So if you look at the organizational strategy, you got to be able to translate that into talent strategies. And so knowing how to build that muscle is huge. And then the other bucket is someone that's seen around the corners and say, okay, here's where you're going. And this is where I'm getting to your point about the C-suite and the boards. They're asking for more help on that third bucket. So if we are in a Horizon 1 company, if we're growing to $1 billion or $1 billion to $4 and $4 to beyond, it requires different skills. It requires a different org design. Perhaps it requires more complexity if you're global and you have, you know, a whole bunch of different products, et cetera. And so a board is looking for the talent, the CEO and the chief people officer, to look at the talent, what you have today and where you need to go, and reverse engineer, like, do we have enough decision makers at scale that know how to predict where we're going so we can make fewer mistakes? Not like be perfect, but make fewer mistakes. Does that HR leader get in the room on the talent assessment, both to develop them, make them athletes, make them rotate so they can touch what I call the elephant of an organization, so we can ensure that we're scaling and have the historical knowledge you need to scale going forward. And so boards, I know from my end, it's like, what's your 3 to 5 year plan? What's the cost of talent? Where's your equity plan coming from? Like, are you looking at the headwinds? Are you looking at the burn rate, the adjusted burn rate? Do you understand why you're getting pressure to put in incentive comp, PSUs, et cetera? Do you understand the succession plan and the criticality of that now in today's world? Because having a gap in the leadership is costly. If you have the right org design, if you're doing mergers and acquisitions, oh my God, Lars, I can go on and on about all that stuff. So if you're an acquiring company, gosh, you better be in that room. If you're scaling past those horizon lines, you got to create a leadership, a tipping point of leaders to meet that demand. And that's the conversation I'm having in the C-suite, in the boardroom, cost of talent, all of that together. And you have to be ready to engage.
Yeah. Well, no, I appreciate that response. And I want to start opening up to some of the questions that we have coming in from the community. And the first one is, how do you see the board discussions on the hybrid work philosophy evolving recently? You know, we've seen a lot of headlines around RTO, obviously, return to office for those of you not well-versed on HR vernacular and shorthand. But, you know, I think that gets a lot of the headlines. But you work with a lot of boards and you're on boards. Like, how are those conversations around hybrid work evolving, let's just say, over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months?
So I, you know, we all went away where we could, right? And then there was this push to come together again for various reasons. And I think we're kludgy about that. And what's happening in the boards is, and the C-suite, it's kind of like you're some leaders are just putting their hands up in the air and going like, it's not going to be the same. You're going to come into the office episodically for purpose to create community. And then, you know, the building will be empty on Fridays and Mondays, et cetera. And so if you have a systems thinking mindset and you're in customer support or you're in some kind of production site, you're going to look at the quality of the work and the productivity of the work. And so the rigor around goal setting, around measuring performance is just getting more focus because of this return to work. It's becoming an issue with people trying to hire talent. Where will they go? Do they need to relocate? There's more friction there. Like, I can do my job anywhere. I'm a global leader. Why do I have to be in Ohio, right? My family loves being in Minnesota. I'm not going to Ohio, wherever that place is, because they're trying to balance quality of life. And so those conversations continue to be had. I think technology helps. I think creating leaders that understand this distributed workforce engagement and when you bring people together and why. I also think technology will enable us to be better around all of this. I think they're going to look at their footprint and save money on capital investments. They're not going to need as much. They're going to create densification in the buildings they have. They're going to reduce floors or close buildings and sublease. You see it all over the place. So I think you're going to save some money, capital investments, and I think you're going to adjust how you look at talent.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of stick with the technology component for a moment, because this touches on another question that came from the community. But you know, how do you see technology impacting the way that we work and the role of HR in the future? And then as a chief people officer, how is your team preparing for these changes? And I'm not even going to add any context to that, because I certainly have a lot of thoughts. I'm going to keep them to myself because I don't want to steer you in either direction. I'd love to just get your thoughts of like how you think about that today and how you're preparing your team for what is now and what is next.
So I love technology, especially technology that serves employees. Seems to be my heart. So imagine a world. So I have in my mental model an employee journey map, right? From courting talent to making you the offer to onboarding, ramping you up. The big moments that matter and the little smaller ones that matter every day until you offboard to do your next big adventure. I think technology along the way is an enabler for all those major events and make us more human. Imagine I hired you, Lars, and you're a college university student. I made you an offer in August. Congratulations. You can join my HR team. I'm super stoked to have you. And you're going to be gone for 9 months, finishing your last year of university. But my AI partner and my tool knows from your ramp up that Lars is at XYZ college. He's going through his finals in December. It prompts me, the manager, it's a great time to send Lars either a text or an email. Here's a template. He's taking finals. Here's an outline of tips and tricks to study, sleep, eat, and here's a coupon to Domino's Pizza. So I send that to you, Lars, and all of a sudden you think, oh, wow, Pat's really thinking of me. It's personalized. It has this cool vibe to it. You know I care, and the chances of you ghosting me later are like really reduced. So I think if you manage sentiment and leverage nudges along the way, technology is a great gift. I also think technology overall, AI, is going to be amazing. I don't even know all that it could be yet. I'm on the journey along with everyone else, but it's going to take parts of our roles, not all of our roles. I think it's going to help serve the employee base. I think it's going to give me better insights. I think about efficiency and effectiveness will improve. I think compliance will improve. My auditing capability will improve. So if you think about anything with high throughput, it's going to be amazing. Sourcing, you can think about recruiting. You can think about comp analysis. You can think about performance management and using AI to help you really look at the feedback you've been getting and create a robust feedback session and nudge you if you're being biased in any one way. So I think technology is going to be a gift that needs to be harnessed. I see it in my own technology at UKG. I see in others, but the story hasn't been fully written yet.
Yeah. I mean, we're in such early days of this current wave of generative AI specifically. Like AI obviously isn't new. Generative AI isn't necessarily new, but I think with the consumer grade applications of generative AI, starting with ChatGPT's release in November of 2022, that is the big shift. And I'm curious for you, like, obviously, you know, UKG, you work for a HR tech company. And so clearly AI infused, I imagine, a lot of your different offerings. Imagine many of the tools that you and those listening use either have begun incorporating generative AI or certainly it's on their roadmap, right? But I'm curious to get your perspective, like as an individual, as a chief people officer with, you know, a big scope and a big set of responsibilities, how are you, kind of mentioned you're on your learning journey, just like all of us, like, how are you using generative AI today? I shouldn't say how, are you, like personally, and what are some ways that you might use it if so?
Yes, I'm using it. I'm using it to think through both in our own company about performance feedback, like how do you give feedback? How do you structure conversations? How do you think through goal setting? So certain tools using generative AI. The organization is also having what you would call hackathons, right? So you're bringing different functions across the entire company together, figure out how can you leverage and insert. So we have partners like Google come in and talk about AI and the tools out there and how can you use, you know, just how do you do a prompt? As simple as that, how do you do a prompt? Gosh, that I was sucked at it at first, Lars. I'm not even great at it now, but the prompt.
I mean, we all did, to be fair, we all used it like Google, you know, it's just.
it's hard. And I'm actually writing a book and I never thought I'd write a book, by the way, as an introvert. I'm really scared about all this, but in the process of talking to the publisher when they reached out and their contractor, like, if you use, you know, ChatGPT AI, let us know. And I'm like, I didn't even think about using ChatGPT. Like, there's so many applications out there on my journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I think that the pace at which this is evolving is unlike anything we've seen in technology. And I mean, since the early emergence of social media, right? I don't think we've seen anything. And even this is moving at a much faster pace than like the, you know, old school Friendster days, right? When we began to see social media, we began interacting with each other online outside of core forums. It's fascinating to see the pace at which it goes. And, you know, even for people who pay attention to this stuff, who are like analysts, it's hard to keep up with what's happening. So I appreciate you giving us a window just into how you use it. And I think I certainly encourage anybody listening to this, you've got to make time for this. Like now is the time. Next year is going to be too late. And I can keep thinking about, you mentioned that there are certain, aspects of our work and our role that, generative AI will take, and it will. And there's some aspects that it won't, but I think that, the quote I always come back to is, Scott Galloway kind of saying, you know, AI won't take your jobs. Humans using AI will. And I think that it's just such an important point for all of us as practitioners to know that this is not a trend. This is not like a, you know, oh, this will just fade out, right? This is an NFTs, right? This is not the metaverse. This is something that it will fundamentally change much of what we do. And if we're not making time for this now, we will be falling behind. So just a quick call to action to everybody listening. I want to come back into some of the questions that are coming from the community. And the first one is on the topic of layoffs. And I'm curious to get your perspective, you know, how do you think that the layoff trends in the U.S. may be affecting employer brands? And what would you advise HR leaders to think about in order to influence CEOs and the board on this topic? So, you know, some companies seemingly have been pretty cavalier with layoffs and maybe are not taking into consideration the employer brand hit that they may take. I would almost say, and I wrote about this actually on LinkedIn earlier this year, is that I think that the frequency and the volume of layoffs, especially in tech, may start to diminish the employer brand hit that is associated with layoffs. I don't like that. I think that's not a good thing. But I do think that that is something that we will see more of. And I'm curious to get your take, you know, especially again, with your lens of working closely with boards, working closely with executive teams, are they still using the employer brand hit with layoffs as a calculus in their decisions.
They always think about the employer, employee brand. And if they're not, they're kind of silly, right? Yeah. So I think when they're cavalier, they're not thinking about the brand. They're thinking about their product brand and not their employee brand when they go too fast. At times when they actually pause, slow their roll and think about the impact of, you know, recruiting and retention and engagement, discretionary effort, clarity in the business, the context you need to give when you do a layoff, all those need to be threaded through a lens of an employee to make sense, right? And so layoffs have always been in the arsenal, right? If you think of a tool to create a high-performing company, a financially responsible company, when you do mergers, when you acquire companies, when you experience financial issues to survive, they tighten their belts, right? They focus. If they got defocused and had too much going on, they focus. And that contraction leads to reduction in jobs. So how you do it is what I focus on. Like if the business decision is a sound one, which I'll push on, by the way, y'all should all push on them. Like, is this the right decision at the right time? Or are we cutting little bits and pieces and eroding trust along the way, right? Do we have a real business case? Then how do you do it? How do you do it with grace? How do you make sure that the managers are prepared? How do you make sure that you're providing support to the employees that are exiting and for the teams that are staying? The biggest complaint that I've seen over and over again is where organizations have cut resources, but not had a plan on the go forward motion.
Yeah.
So same amount of work, same productivity, fewer people. How do we do it? And we don't have the tools. Like I'm suffering and burnout was already an issue. So you're impacting an already fragile ecosystem. So thinking about the cost of yes, of doing that decision over time. And I think for some, it's, you know, you get that positive pop in the market, right? When you do a reduction, right? You get your stock up. You have money to invest in other locations, you know, meaning products or services or whatever it is for the market to compete better. But are you telling the employees exactly what you're doing, giving the signals in advance? Are you supporting them? Are you compassionate in the communication? All that matters.
Yeah. I mean, and I appreciate that walkthrough, just all the points that as a CPO, you need to be thinking about. And equally as importantly, you have to be advising your C-suite peers about to ensure they are thinking about that. It's not just a bottom line decision. It's not just a business decision. It impacts, you know, both the people who are impacted by layoffs and obviously the people who are staying and the employer brand hit, right? It's like there's multiple layers to this that I think have to be considered. I have to be part of the calculus in how you make this decision, but then also how you manage the outcome of the decision, you know, with compassion, with support. Those things are all really, really key. I want to get into your thoughts for a moment on skills. You know, we're kind of, as we look at this new world of work that we're building, you know, one of the, what I wouldn't even call trends anymore, I think we've been talking about this for a while, but we're starting to see it more, is, you know, skills really being something that kind of underpins how we think about recruiting, retention, development, career pathing. And I want to apply that to you for a moment. This is not a question kind of coming from the community, but you know, what skills and even experiences were most valuable in your career journey, particularly as you were kind of ascending to the CPO role?
So Lars, I wanted to be head of HR since I was 19. Like that was my compass, my due north. I learned from my uncle that 80% of a company's operational expense is the cost of talent. So how do you recruit, retain, develop, engage? And I wanted to run all those knobs, right? And at the time, women did not run HR. So I kept on saying, well, honey, do a comp analyst or do a recruiter job. Or I'm like, no, I want this job, right? And so I crafted my path to enable me to do this job. So the first decade, assume first 12 years, I rotated across the craft. So I did 3 years probably in each stint in recruiting and compensation, employee relations, you name it, right? To learn the craft. It was really important. Then I actually left the function a couple of times. I went in to do sales. I wanted to understand when we got pushback on an initiative, timing's not right. Like this is going to distract the managers or blah, 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 right? I want to understand, what do they mean by that? You know, the P&L, the quarterly close, how do I understand the financial impact of our decisions in the field? And so I did sales for a bit. Then at Applied Materials, I went into operations and implemented Oracle and did business management change practice and process design and did a build plan for one of our divisions. And those business skills, that walking in their shoes, was probably the most valuable experience besides learning the craft that enabled me to sit in this chair. Full stop. Like, yeah. It made me humble. I made mistakes. I learned, and I had empathy for them. And my whole job is to make them successful. I am very clear what my purpose is.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
From LinkedIn News, I'm Jesse Hempel, host of the Hello Monday podcast. In my 20s, I knew what career success looked like. In midlife, it's not that simple. Work is changing, we're changing, and there's no guidebook for how to make sense of it. So come figure it out with me on the Hello Monday podcast. I've been a journalist for 2 decades, writing cover stories for Business Week, Fortune, and Wired. And now, every Monday, I bring you conversations with people who are thinking deeply about work and where it fits into our lives, like Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella on growth mindsets.
The learn-it-all does better than the know-it-all.
Or NYU professor Scott Galloway on choosing a career.
I think the worst advice you can give a kid is follow your passion.
Or MacArthur Genius winner Angela Duckworth on talent versus grit.
Your long-term effort and your long-term commitment are surprisingly important.
Each episode delivers pragmatic advice for right now. Listen to Hello Monday with me, Jesse Hempel, on the LinkedIn Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm so glad you touched on that experience getting into the business, because I do think, you know, we talk about business acumen and business fluency and so many aspects of, you know, a modern CEO is a business leader. It's not an HR leader. You know, you have to have a mastery of this work in these fields. And as you mentioned, an understanding of total rewards, comp, and recruiting, but like, you're driving the business and you have to see your role that way. And so I always encourage people, if that is your goal, if that is your path, and you have an opportunity to move inside of the business, Pat, you share a lot of common background that I think a lot of what I would consider to be elite chief people officers have, which is spending some time in the business for all the reasons you mentioned. And so that's great advice. And I hope people heed that. I want to stay with the skills theme just for a moment. You know, when you think about, we're kind of in this unique environment in the market right now where you mentioned burnout. We are seeing a lot of experienced chief people officers moving out of the field, moving into coaching, moving into consulting, taking sabbaticals, just taking time off. The need isn't shrinking. The need is actually increasing because more companies are realizing they need to be investing in stronger leaders sooner. So you have a shortened supply, you have a heightened demand, and that's creating an environment where you have a lot of first-time heads of people who are moving into this role for the first time. And I think a lot of the, you know, community members here fit that category, right? They're either in that role for the first time now, or maybe that's going to be their next role. And I want to get your perspective on skills, because I think with a lot of these heads of people, they're moving into that role and maybe they've done a few tours of duty in different areas of HR as you did, right? Maybe they've spent some time in different functions. And so they have mastery usually of a couple functions, but having not been in that head of people, there are certain things that they haven't seen, yep. They haven't experienced, they don't have a point of view on, they don't have a point of reference on. And so what advice do you have for those leaders? Somebody, let's just say they're a senior director, or they're a VP like you, they aspire to be a CPO. what are skills that they can begin investing in now in themselves to have them better prepared to be successful when they do make that transition?
Couple of things come to mind, Lars. One is that growth mindset, because you're not always going to get it right, and mistakes make you learn, right? So lean into what you're learning and learn it fast. Be curious and absorb the learning. I think the magic sauce in anybody growing in their career and doing this craft is co-creation. It means that I don't have all the information. I pick a few dance partners along the way, someone in professional services and in engineering that you know, I think has, you know, a broad perspective, someone in sales. Like, I want to touch the elephant. I want to make sure I'm looking holistically at the business ecosystem and come together and say, if we're going to like really increase our accountability, what tools, what approaches do you think work, don't work, and why not? And then they co-create a couple of ideas with me. Then we test them out. We do a proof of concept and for engagement. And then together, the business rolls it out. I'm an enabler. I'm part of the team, but it's not HR initiative, right? So if you're growing and you're new in role, co-creation, business-led, open up your aperture of learning, touch the elephant. You know, if you know the analogy of the elephant and the blind monks, what you see, what you think you understand as the solution may not be the full thing. So that humility to seek more input and actively listen and partner with others, I think is an amazing skill set. And the agility to know when you're wrong and you course correct makes the journey actually more fun, Lars.
Yeah. You know, that co-creation piece is so important because I think especially for first-time leaders, you know, you probably have moments when you feel you're in over your head. And that may make you overcompensate by trying to showcase that you are competent and you have ideas and you're smart, and that may make you feel that you have to have the answers even when you don't. But that actually will backfire. That will be clear to the business leaders that you're actually over your skis a little bit on that. So it's okay to not know. It's okay to ask questions. And again, when you frame this around co-creating, you're bringing them in. You know, the day of HR, like going back in a room and cobbling something together and just pushing it out to the business, it's done. It's a recipe for disaster. So you co-create early, you bring them in, you create advocates and champions and peers, you're going to be much more successful. I want to take the skills kind of, you know, topic from another angle. This kind of connects back to another question coming from the community, is how do you think about creating and implementing an internal skills marketplace at a company like UKG. So we're ensuring the right people are in the right roles, and it helps enable internal mobility. I mean, to me, I think this is the thing that we haven't quite cracked yet, but it's going to be, when we do, it's going to be so powerful. And this is where tools like AI will help us. But you know, when we could really map skills and identify those even in non-linear roles, then we're creating opportunities for people that may have never known that they could move into X role or Y team because they had no idea those skills were transferable. So how do you, I guess philosophically, how do you think about that? And then specifically kind of how do you manage that within your team and within the business at UKG?
Well, first off, I'd like anyone in the audience that has that answer, like, please type an email the answer. This is where we need to crowdsource and co-create. This is kind of like the Holy Grail and or a Pandora's box,
yeah.
Right? Because skills atrophy. Like, if you think about what was important a decade ago, is kind of like antiquated now in some skills. Now you have new skills like ethics with AI, right? And compliance, and you have ESG work, and like you have this emergence of skills. And so I think, you know, some of the work that LinkedIn did about soft skills being the hard skills really come to mind. I think that if you can codify and understand the athletes, the curiosity, the growth mindset, the things where people lean in, learn, iterate, have the resiliency to grow, those things are way more valuable to me in an organization than knowing how to build a widget. Right. Yeah. I can teach you how to build a widget. I can't give you self-motivation and curiosity and care. Right. So some of these things are really hard. I do think that we have to get way better, including UKG, at talent rotation, at creating those athletes. I know I get super stoked when I look at someone for a gig that has been in different industries, in different functions, and have been successful. Talk about being uncomfortable. Talk about like the imposter syndrome. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, you bet on me. So now I'm going to learn how to make a widget or a basket or a thing. And the trust you gave me makes me lean in more, and I'm going to learn more, and I'll be more humble in my learning. So I love that agility experience. It tells me so much about you. So if you're a one trick pony, just going up one career path, I worry about your ability to navigate change, right? To be curious, because you have such strong pattern recognition. So I think our skill building and experience building and getting you out of your comfort zone is just as important as your subject matter expertise. And look for those moments. And I think we have to use AI to do that. I think it has to be dynamic. It's not a one size fits all. And like I said, if I could have a widget that would tell me, I have a vision of a NOC. If anyone knows what a NOC is, it's think about your operations center, your network operating center, where you have your IT network gurus looking at so many screens to make sure that your system is online, your customer data is flowing, you can operate your business. What if you had that for talent? What if you understood if you had a gray out or a blackout where the talent is to solve that particular problem? That would be really, really cool. If you had over usage, under usage of a skill set, how do you develop more? Who's raising their hand to learn more? And how do you pull that in and codify that and you leverage that? That to me would be nirvana. I don't think anyone solved that yet, Lars. So thank you for that very easy, easy question you threw at me.
I didn't see that yet. If anybody's listening and you're working on that, there's a market. So good luck and let us know.
Yes. Sierra, LinkedIn is working on it, trying. I know. But it's by company. It's so hard to do. This is hard.
Well, you know, and I also appreciate you raising the point around the shelf life of skills, right? Because that is actually shrinking. And so the last data I saw was maybe 2.8 years on average is the average shelf life of skills. And so, yeah, if we're purely looking at talent management internally from a existing skills perspective, that is going to have some flaws pretty quickly. So, I want to kind of shift over towards a topic you mentioned earlier in the chat, which is M&A. And I know you've been through, you know, M&As as a people leader. What tips do you have for companies who, you know, maybe HR leaders who are in the acquiring company and they want to really help integrate the acquired company's talent into the business and the culture and really, what are some of the important considerations to help them feel like they're part of the new organization?
The simple things matter most. How do you welcome somebody, right? One of my mistakes that I've done, and I continue to do every now and then until I remind myself and someone points it out to me, like, you know, the welcome and greeting someone in your home is such a big deal, right? Think about it that way. And so if someone walks in your home and you kind of ignore them, they're not going to stay in your home long. They're not going to come back. So if you're acquiring a company, they're really anxious. And so how do you welcome them? How do you make it personable? Because it is personal to them. There's going to be some change. There's going to be an org shift. You might integrate them right away. Some might have a gig. Some may not have a gig. And so giving context, showing compassion, being there for them is really important. Bringing the swag. I know we laugh sometimes about a t-shirt or buying, you know, the book with the logos, but getting them future focused is super important. You're no longer pink, you're purple, right? And pink is part of purple, and we're super excited to have you part of this new organization. So welcoming, being intentional, and echoing why this acquisition was so important. What I find that a lot of companies fail to do, and that's why acquisitions fail 80% of the time, is that we don't really amplify why behind the acquisition. Is it for the tech? If it's purely for the IP and the tech, let's be clear and not hold people to something else. They might perceive it to be something else. Is it about the tech and the customer? Is it about the talent? You can do acqui-hires. There's so many reasons why you would do an acquisition. Be clear about what success looks like. Be clear if you're acquiring talent and IP, how long that talent needs to stay in your organization to transfer their knowledge to your company. So even when I was at LinkedIn, we got really clear about, look, we're going to acquire this company X with these skills, these individuals. We're going to be intentional with cross-pollinization of their skills into our team. They're going to be leaders of others, and they're going to have goals to allow them to transfer that knowledge and that passion and that experience to others so it gets amplified. And our assumption set is that if they're a serial entrepreneur, they'll leave in 2 years, whatever that thing is. And so we're more intentional about that, what that looks like. So that's if you're acquiring. Welcome. Be intentional about the why. Measure, you know, the value proposition, why you did, and have the rigor along the way. If you're going to integrate quickly, don't let it linger. Because if you're leaving it alone for a year, they're going to think that's there forevermore. And when you do change it, they think you broke a promise. So be quick. Rip the Band-Aid off. And if you're being acquired, again, be clear about why are you being acquired? What's the promise? And if you're the CPO, be the champion for your employees to make sure that they're cared for. Raise your hand. Be the one that shakes the tree that says, we are walking into your home. Welcome us warmly. Like, I have done that. Like, make sure you care for my employees. They're amazing. Even if you don't want them for long term, they're here right now helping you with this acquisition. So I am their biggest advocate. I'm their biggest guide. I will like put every effort in to make sure that that welcoming in that home is huge.
Yeah. And I appreciate you hitting both dimensions of that, both the kind of acquirer and acquiree, with some, you know, practical and actionable tips. I want to shift out from M&A to another topic that I know, you know, you and other CPOs have experienced quite a bit over the last couple of years. And as we head into what's surely to be a tense political cycle here in the U.S., we're going to be facing again. But the questions around, you know, what are your thoughts on a company's role in keeping employees engaged during polarizing geopolitical times? And do you have any practical tips for people leaders who are trying to navigate their employees through these?
I think here's what I've done in the past. Here's what I'm thinking about this year. You know, there's a point of view that's valid on all sides of every argument. And I don't want to persuade anyone to think like me, right? What I do want is to teach my leaders and my frontline managers how to care with grace, right? If someone's struggling with the environment, understand that they are, and don't be impatient. Like, how do you lead with compassion and clarity and support? It is an emotional thing. And as organizations, you know, take the individual manager out of it. If, as an organization, certain political landscapes challenge your foundational beliefs as a company. So if you believe in creating, you know, economic opportunity for all, that means that you'll fight for women's rights in every country to work, right? You will, if you believe in careers, right, and everyone has an opportunity to work, then you need to think about it, food insecurity at a young age, because if you have food insecurity in a family, then those young adults will be focused on eating, not on their education. And there's a lot of studies around that. And so you might index on these tenants, if you will. And so from a political landscape, what you lobby for and what you support and how you show up at the state level and the federal level and the country level may vary based upon what you believe in. But the core of the core, everyone's going to go through something. Just, you know, be appreciative of what they do every day at work. Thank them. Show up with humility and care, and to be clear on the goals and what success looks like and why you're there, so they feel safe, right? You're not going to create a tense environment. That's the best advice I can give you.
I'm going to shift into somewhat rapid fire for our last 10 minutes, because the questions keep coming. I want to cover as many as we can together. And the next one is regarding change. Organizations are going through a lot of change. People are experiencing massive amounts of change fatigue as a result. And so with all these changes organizationally, what are your thoughts on just, you know, change management in general and best practices or approaches on how we can better and proactively equip ourselves and our teams, our managers, our executives, really all the stakeholders to more effectively drive change within the business.
So change the framing in your brain, first and foremost, right? If you just look at it as being hit with a bunch of different changes, you're going to get fatigued, you're going to get bruised, it's going to be overwhelming. If you think about all these things as evolution and an opportunity to learn and experiment and drive and evolve, then you have higher energy and resilience. So think about the things that make you more resilient. The growth mindset being perfectly imperfect. I do make mistakes. And so if I try something out, even when I co-create, it doesn't quite hit where I want to. I don't go in this trough of the despair. I turn my language in my head, go, guess what I got to learn today, right? I got to learn this. And that gives me energy. When my team comes to me like, you won't believe the systems integration and they changed, they implemented this and we lost this data or we can't process this. And I go, wow, that's great to learn. What's our recovery plan? How are we going to ensure it doesn't happen again? That is a phenomenal learning. Are we going to repeat this process in any other country? And can we avoid those things? So how you respond to change around you and mistakes and learnings as a leader really, really changes the tonality and the resilience of your team. And then watching the organization ebb and flow. So if they're on a sprint, give them that Friday off, right? Recognize that you have sprints and sometimes it's a marathon. And so be intentional with those moments of deep breathing and laughter. I tend to go in drive mode when I get anxious, Lars, and I tell my team, I'm in drive mode today, and like on my list. And then I have people, accountability partners, say, Waters, like slow your roll, like appreciate the team. Like we've been working hard. And so I ask them to remind me to slow down and pause and reflect and thank people. And that also helps us with the changes because that's not going to stop. My whole point is that change is going to continue. Think about AI. It's happening and it's exciting and we're going to grow from it.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate you saying that and your comments on failure. Maybe come back to a quote from AJ Thomas, who is the coolest title in HR. She's a chaos pilot of people and products at the Moonshot Factory. And obviously they're a very, they're an organization built on taking moonshots, which are obviously majority of those are going to not work. But they call fail first attempt in learning.
Love that.
I love it. Yeah. It speaks so much to it. It's just a simple reframing of how you think about it. And so just as I love the way you describe it. I think it's so consistent with that model of like, this isn't a failure. It's an opportunity to learn and we're going to be better from it. So I really like that. I want to come back to hybrid, the topic of hybrid for a moment. And another question coming from the community is what advice do you have for people ops teams to ensure that hybrid teams are sustainable and thrive? Do you have any specific tactics or strategies that have been particularly impactful in managing and leading hybrid teams?
Couple of tactics, right? So one is, episodically, quarterly, monthly, have everyone be virtual for a meeting, for like an ops review or a team meeting, and create some team building in that virtual environment. For example, don't let them put in a background. See their home if they're comfortable. See their home. Most people would. They'd find a niche in their home to do this. They've figured out their space during COVID. And what I did is a show and tell moment to get to know the human. I think it's incredibly important to build community and you can do it virtually. And so you take an object from your work location. Typically we all have something that we love around us. It gives us warmth. For me, I shared one time a Lego that my daughter made, that I kept at my desk because she has special needs and she gets high anxiety when I travel. And so when I was initially starting out back to travel, I'd get her these Lego sets and she would make them. It'd be a Yoda, it'd be Star Wars or Harry Potter, whatever it was. But she would send me snapshots of her creations. And so that's how we stayed connected when I traveled and I shared that with my team and they got to know me and my daughter and they got to say hi to her. Recently, my dad passed. And so I painted that painting behind me. It was the day he went into hospice and it was my way of expressing my love and the colors of the ocean. He lived by the ocean. And it reminded me all the journey ahead was just going to be about love. And so I share that. So if you do that in a virtual room and everyone gets to do a show and tell, and then you can create a pod where five people come together and say, what do you do with that object to escape or survive on a deserted island? The fun that comes out of that, Lars, is hysterical. We're going to sail away on the painting, or we're going to go on a ship, or that creates, you know, apple juice for everyone. Who knows? So that's one. Virtually, make sure everyone has empathy for being virtual. The other thing is bring them together in cohorts or all together if you can afford it in locations, so they can get the energy and the contagious smiles and the water cooler talk. That's super important. Have the lunches, have the time together, see each other, hug each other if appropriate. But those two things, being intentional, helps the community stay tight.
Yeah. Well, Pat, this has been a tremendous learning experience for me, selfishly, but I think for all the community members and all the people who will be listening to this discussion. I have one last question I want to raise to you from the community. And it's about the topic of flexibility at work. So, you know, employees tend to want autonomy to pursue other interests and passions, whether they're paid or unpaid, outside of their main job. And this notion can be scary to companies that have a fixed mindset. So how do you see employee expectations of work life and personal life integrating, continuing to shift the work landscape?
I think you already nailed it. Some companies will embrace it and go on the journey with the employee base. Others won't. Like, they have the rigor, they have the scheduling issues. Think about healthcare, think about retail. But you know, you choose it, like, what are the motivators that you have as an individual? What are your values? And then you put yourself in the environment that enables you to do that. And if you have a commitment to a company, I will deliver these goods. Like, this is my promise to you. In return, I get this flexibility. If you meet that promise, then you should be cool, right? My company shouldn't care if I like to bartend at night. I don't do that, by the way. I couldn't be a bartender. But it's not in conflict of, not in competition with, doesn't impact the quality of my work the next day. Like, why not? Right? Why not? I love the creative outlets. I wish more people would do that.
Yeah. Well, Pat, thank you so much for spending some time with all of us, answering all the questions from the Amplified Talent community members. And thanks just again for your leadership in the space. I just appreciate the way that, you know, you openly share what you're learning, how you're growing, what you're navigating, and I think that openness makes it us all better. So I just want to end with some gratitude towards you, and thank you for making time for this and just all of your collaboration and partnership.
Thank you. Love the questions. Love the partnership. Like I said, when you call, Lars, I answer. So anytime I can help.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of LinkedIn Presents Redefining Work. For more information on the podcast, past episodes, future guests, and more, be sure to check out our website at amplifytalent.com/redefining-work. And if you want to connect with me directly, you can find me on my website at larsschmidt.com, or feel free to post on social using the hashtag #redefiningwork, and I will find you. And if you dig this podcast, I'd love for you to share it with your peers and your friends and help them discover it. And if you really dig this podcast, please leave a review on whatever podcast delivery your ears prefer. I'll see you next week.